Good morning. Ken Grundfest. I'm sorry. I'm going to be the moderator for this panel. Just have a seat. These are our panelists who I will introduce. So on your far right, on my right here, Julie Way from Kansas City, Scott Manning from Seattle, Peter Weisskopf from Phoenix, Dr. Carla Zimmerman from Tempe, Arizona, and at the end, on your left, Ron Eavy from Nashville. We're going to be talking today about the evaluation of the child suspected of having speech delay, and the title of the panel discussion is meant to convey that we're not really here to talk about the severely hearing impaired deaf child who's delayed in speech development. We all understand that if you're severely hearing impaired in both ears, there could be and often is a delay in speech development. What we're talking about is the child is referred by a local pediatrician or family physician or self-referred by a parent who says something like, my son Johnny, who's 22 months old, is not speaking any words that I can understand, but his older sister Sally was speaking two and three word sentences by age 2 years. So the question is, what's wrong with Johnny? So Carla, I have your slides here, and if you just say next, I'll go through them. But
Okay, great.
So we'd like to hear at first from a speech pathologist. And the way I think we can do this, I know how many slides we have. I know approximately how long each speaker will take to convey the information they have. I think it'll work best if, as we're going through it, if you have a question, and you probably will, some people might, just go to the microphone, and I think we'll work that in. I will keep my eye on the time. And this is for you all. We want to make sure that you leave the room today knowing more about how to assess a child suspected of having speech delay. And I keep saying suspected because it's relative. Not everybody who the mother or father thinks is delayed in developing speech actually is. So Carla, can you help us with this?
Sure. The first thing I want to talk about is the terminology speech delay. One of the things that, as a speech pathologist, that we look at is there are several components at play. One is speech, which generally refers to articulation. So those would be the children who come in who are not intelligible or are very difficult to understand, but seem to be talking. The other area would be language, where the children maybe aren't trying to talk at all or have very delayed content that they're expressing. And so when we're looking at children, we're looking at both of those areas. There are some gender differences. Girls outpace boys until about the age of 4 or 5, but the difference there is only a matter of months. And so if you've got a little boy who's lagging behind, we don't want to assume that it's just because he's a boy, but there is a difference. Boys babble later, they talk later, and unfortunately they're three times more likely to have delayed communication development as compared to girls. That goes away at about the age of 5, but early on they're at risk. Go ahead.
So have you all noticed that that more of the concern is about male children? That's my impression. I agree with that.
One of the issues that you want to consider is late talkers. So late talkers would be toddlers who are beginning to talk 18 months to 30 months. They appear to have good understanding, but they're not talking very well yet. A lot of the kids who are later defined as late talkers actually will develop communication skills that are within normal limits. About 35% up to 60% of late talkers are going to outgrow their problem. The problem, though, is that we don't know who those kids are. We can't look at them and say, this is the late talker who's going to outgrow their problem, and this is a late talker who's not going to outgrow their problem. We do know that there are some risk factors. So go ahead to the next slide.
Yeah, before we go ahead, does anybody on the panel yet have any disagreement with what Dr. Zimmerman has said? Most of us agree.
Okay.
I certainly agree. Go ahead.
Okay. Some of the risk factors are that the child didn't do a lot of babbling, a history of ear infections, which we know is not causal but can be related, a limited number of consonant sounds, a lot of vowels rather than consonants. They don't link pretend ideas and actions together when they're playing. So you have a child who, rather than picking up the baby doll and pretending to feed the baby doll or taking the cars and driving them, they're playing with toys in a less purposeful, meaningful way. They don't imitate words. They use mainly nouns and very few verbs. They have a hard time playing with their peers. And then the last three are the ones that are really the greatest risk factors. These are the things that we care most about. If there's a family history of communication delay, learning or academic difficulties, that is a red flag. If there's a mild comprehension delay for their age, that's another red flag. So we're talking about the kids who do well being the kids who, they're not talking a lot yet, but they understand really well. And the parents usually have a pretty good handle on that. They'll say, oh, they understand everything, but they're not talking. Those kids I'm not as worried about as the kid who doesn't appear to be understanding very well. And also a child who doesn't use very many gestures to communicate.
So Carla, we've talked about this before. Anecdotally, I have the impression that when a boy is actually delayed in developing speech and comes at age 18 to 20 months with virtually no words, this is just anecdotal, but I have the impression that if I ask the parents if either of them had any speech delay, it's not uncommon that the father did. Is any of the other panelists noticed this? I know you're shaking your heads. Carla, is it a known fact? I never found it in the literature, other than what you mentioned, some family.
Well, there have been a few genetic markers found. There have been some family groups that have been identified that we know that there does appear to be some genetic link. But in terms of communication development as a whole, stuttering and other issues as well, we do tend to see that it kind of runs in families.
Anybody in the audience recognized, or am I the only one that ever noticed this correlation? Looks like maybe I am. Julie, did you want anybody else up here want to comment on this?
Usually in an office visit, even if both parents are there, the father hardly ever says a word.
There you go.
Okay. So here's a question. Now we have the child who's speech delayed. I don't know whether speech therapy helps or not. I know I've heard the term early intervention. I know that in certain counties and locales in the United States, it's easily available for the family and often paid for by the government. So does speech therapy help?
Well, I like to think so, since that's my job. Speech therapy for children who need it can be helpful. One of the issues about early intervention is that there is a window of development for children, and if we catch the children early enough that they're still in that window of rapid potential learning, we can get a lot more bang for our buck. We can make a lot more progress quickly. We can also head off a problem so that we don't have a long-term problem, hopefully. When you see a child who has red flags that you're concerned about, we would recommend that any toddler who has a limited vocabulary and any of the risk factors just gets sent off for a consultation for a screening with the speech-language pathologist. Now, depending on the age of the child, if you've got a child who's under 3 years old, every state has some form of early intervention program, and some states are easier to get into than others. But every state does have that. And so if there's a child that you're not sure, that you look at them and you think, well, maybe there's a problem, maybe there's not a problem, you can always refer them to your state agency who does early intervention and have them do a screening. And that would determine whether or not they feel like there is a reason to pursue that. If it's a child who's a little bit older, who's a child who's three, then we want to refer them to their school district, because the school district will do the same thing. They'll do a screening. If there's need for an evaluation, they'll do that. And so that takes the load off of you. You don't have to decide whether or not there is a problem or isn't a problem. You just have to say, there are enough red flags here that I have a concern and I want to follow up.
Julie, question? Yes.
Kenny, do you think, excuse me, I've had my practice, speech delay, where, and maybe this is anecdotal, right, we'll usually ask the mother, you're right, the father doesn't say anything, we'll usually ask the mother, does the little boy have older sisters?
And what's the implication?
The sisters talk for the little boy.
Ah.
And
panelists,
a lot of times,
please comment.
A lot of times if we see little boys who've got talkative older siblings, we might not see them talking a lot, but we would see them understanding well. And so our concern is more with the children who don't show good understanding, as well as are having difficulty with communication.
Okay.
But it is interesting that when you have those, because I have
just
seen...
Just use the microphone. Yeah, sure.
It is interesting when you have those patients, because I've seen the same thing. Sometimes that's the cue for that parent to really be worried, because they've got a really talkative young girl, and then the little boy doesn't, and that's what brings up that first question.
They get accustomed to the point at which speech develops, and the girls have kind of hit that milestone, but the boy didn't. They get very worried. Interesting point. Julie, were you going to comment?
Yeah, just the same experience as everyone else is often the mom will say to me, is this because this is the third child and the youngest child? So we do hear that very commonly in the office. Certainly I can't state with literature evidence that that's the case, but I think all of us always make sure that we don't just assume that's the reason without giving that child the benefit of the evaluation.
Scott, please go ahead.
Yeah. And I think you're going to get into this, but my specific question is a clinician. So let's say they just turned two, it's going to be a year before the school will do it, and we have concerns, but then I want to know what specific things should trigger me to refer in my system to SpeechPath because we can't use the school.
Well, you should be able to get into some early intervention program because the states do have to do that. But
how do I decide who I should do?
I would say the red flags that we talked about. If you've got a child who's got poor vocabulary, a very low vocabulary, a child who doesn't seem to be understanding well, a lot of the children that are going to be coming into you are potentially kids who are autism spectrum kids. The rate of autism spectrum is really high right now. And so the chance is that that you're the first stop or the second stop on their search for what's really wrong with this child, and they're hoping that it's going to be you who figures that out versus having to go to a developmental pediatrician.
So that's an important point, and I want to make sure again that people leave this room today getting a better understanding of the early clues to autism spectrum disorder than you had when you came in the room, because the child who's delayed in speech development who comes to the otolaryngologist for assessment of hearing with the primary care physician thinking that the hearing is the problem, and you do an assessment, the ears are normal, the hearing is normal, you can do one of several things. You can just send the patient back to the family physician and say, we've ruled out otitis media and hearing loss, but if you don't consider autism spectrum, it may be months to a year before that child reenters the medical care system, and probably something could have been done in that year if you made an early diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Scott, I think you were going to comment, and then we're going to let Carla finish up with her slides. It's covered? Okay. So this is case number two. My daughter, Michelle, who's 18 months, is not saying any words yet. I've noticed that there's a white band of some kind underneath her tongue, and my mother says that this could be causing Michelle's delayed speech. My mother thinks that the scar band underneath the tongue should be clipped. Doctor, is this something you would advise? What does the speech pathologist tell us?
Well, if I have a child who's not saying any words yet, that's a language problem. It's not a speech problem. And so a frenulectomy is not going to take care of that problem. But when we talk about tongue tie or ankyloglossia, the tongue doesn't have to extend a very great deal to make most sounds. The furthest it needs to go is really the alveolar ridge. So if you can get your tongue up to the alveolar ridge to do the L, the T, the D, you're probably going to be okay. The most elevation is required for the L, and so if you do it to yourself, L, you can feel that. But you can also put your tongue behind your lower teeth and get an L, L, and it's acoustically fine. Same thing for the TH. You can do it down low rather than up high. And so if I see a child who's got speech issues, my first line of attack is going to be, what can we do about the speech issues? And if we can't deal with the speech issues, then we might recommend seeking a frenulectomy.
So how many people in the audience, just raise your hand, if a child's referred to you delayed in speech development, and the parent or pediatrician has been concerned about what they view as a short frenulum, how many of you proceed to do a frenulectomy? Almost nobody, a few people do. So would you comment, Julie, what do you do?
Well, first of all, I think it's my job to make sure, is it really anatomically an issue? So if it's mild or non-existent, we've all seen those patients where we assure the family and say we respectfully disagree, there is no ankyloglossia. But if you have moderate or severe, I counsel them that, yeah, I think that it's reasonable to consider that, because rarely do you get feeding problems, certainly no airway problems because of it. But I also set the tone and explain that that's not going to increase vocabulary. So I try to separate them and not just make it a simplistic decision as a glorified plumber technician.
Question from the audience.
Yeah, I only know what I've been taught and what I believe, but I don't have any data to substantiate this. I believe that ankyloglossia, unless it's very severe, probably does not affect speech. But it probably does affect quality of life issues. So there's a reason to clip it or to cut it, whichever way you're going to do it. But whether it's going to affect the speech, I'm skeptical. On the other hand, what do you do when you have a speech pathologist who's saying, this needs to be done? Now you have a belief and an expectation by all that it needs to be done. But I've never seen any data or randomized controlled trials showing that it's the case. Is there any data?
So, Farrell, thank you for the question, and I'm going to toss it out to the panel. Here's the issue to the panel. I'm senior to most of you, I think to all of you. From my experience, I came away with two approaches to ankyloglossia. If a neonatologist calls me and says there's a problem with sucking, feeding, latch, I don't argue anymore. I don't believe that it makes a difference. But I found out from experience, it takes more of my energy and more of my time to say that it won't help than to do it. It takes about 5 minutes to do it. If I say it doesn't need to be done, that's about a half hour to 45 minutes, and I have to re-answer the question the following day. Then I have to answer the question again when another neonatologist starts on service. So I do it. When it comes to a child who's 2 to 3 years of age, who's delayed in speech development, I try to talk the parent out of it, because usually that's going to require general anesthesia. But I'm not always successful. I say about half the time am I successful. Panelists, please comment. So let me start with you, Ron. Have you ever faced this issue?
No, I agree.
Scott?
Well, I kind of agree, but I mean, I think we're all salesmen, and it's our job to advocate for the patient and sell it. And I think we can do it. So I have the same thing. I have the babies that are not feeding well. Then I have the older kids. But if it's in the ballpark, like they have a short frenulum, it's L, TH, et cetera, then we'll go for it. But I think I'm a pretty good salesman, and I know Farrell is. So, yeah.
Julie?
Yeah.
Julie?
I just want to comment coming from the perspective of a mother. You know, we can say, you know, I don't think it's going to make a difference, but obviously as a mother, if there's one simple thing you can do so they stop worrying about it, so 4 years later when you can't prove that the reason they're not where they need to be with speech therapy is because of this all along, then why not just fix it and move on?
There's a kernel of major truth there. I'm very serious. Could just say it once more. It's a very wise comment. I totally agree with you. Just restate what you said. The value of doing it is what?
We're talking about patient and family-centered care this morning, and so if you can sense from a mother's standpoint, this is really what's making her lose sleep at night, and she'll continue to seek providers till she gets the services. So if it's anatomically indicated, you think it's reasonable, I say do it.
I love that comment. Somebody, another question, yes.
I'd like to add a comment to this. there's going to be a meeting later today in which we're going to talk about whether we can be ethical in this day and age. With all due respect, I have to argue against what you just said. The patient is the issue, not the mother. I realize when we have pediatric patients, we have to treat the family at the same time. And I agree with your statement, sir. When it's a newborn, where the procedure doesn't require a general anesthetic and it is quick and easy and carries almost no complications, you can't argue with the pediatrician that says there's feeding difficulty. But we know beyond any shadow of a doubt that frenulectomy, frenulotomy, or even as I choose to do it, Z-plasty, to really get extension of the frenulum, has no effect on anything other than possibly the tongue tip sounds, T, D, L, those things, unless the patient is destined to be a world-class tuba player. It will not make any difference. If you've got to do a general anesthetic, we all know that that rare case where you take a healthy child into the operating room for a small procedure and you have to come out and tell the mother, kid's dead. I cannot justify doing an operation solely because the parents want you to do it.
Thank you. Could you tell us your name so we just...
Harvey Tucker, Cleveland.
That's what I thought. I couldn't see that well. Farrell, we're just going to take a brief comment because we want to move on to oral motor. Do you want to just put it out here?
Very brief.
We'll get to
both,
it.
Both viewpoints have validity in my mind. Data would answer it. Is there data?
Thank you. So we do want to cover, and then we're going to move on, oral motor. So this is the child who did have some early feeding problems, might be slightly hypotonic. What about oral motor therapy for the speech-delayed child?
If you've got a child who's got feeding issues, then oral motor therapy is indicated. If you have a child who has speech production errors, oral motor therapy will not affect speech production. There have been a lot of meta-analyses of studies of this, and it's been found to be not effective. So if you have people out there who think that they're going to be doing tongue push-ups and being able to say their S right, it's probably not going to work.
Okay. Case number three. Andrew is 28 months of age and has no speech development. In fact, he does not seem to even want to communicate at all with me or his two other siblings. That's the parent speaking. His motor development has met all milestones, but he does seem excessively irritable at times and does not seem eager to play with other children. Anybody in the audience want to shout out what they think might be wrong with this child? Exactly. So what's wrong with Andrew?
Probably autism spectrum. So the rate right now is 1 in 88 children, five times more likely among boys than girls. It's an umbrella term, and so it doesn't just mean the classic autism with the flapping and the rocking and all of that stuff. There are a lot of variations that fall under that umbrella. But if you see a child who has difficulty with social relationships, in other words, very poor eye gaze, very poor interaction with people, communication issues, any repetitive behaviors or overly restricted interests, there's a really good chance that this child is going to fall into the autism spectrum umbrella. And children can be identified at about 12 to 13 months now. Not everybody's willing to do it, but it can be done. And the bonus of doing that is getting some treatment early on. The DSM-5 is coming out in May, and they're changing the diagnostic criteria and the categories for autism. So I don't know what that will do to the rate, but chances are if you've got a kid who's coming in with social issues, you're talking about autism spectrum.
So I hope you all know about autism spectrum disorder, know how to recognize it. I can tell you, I made a quantum leap in my knowledge about the disorder when about 5 years ago, I had a child with bilateral persistent medullary effusion delayed in developing speech. And we did bring him to the OR, did bilateral meningotomy and insertion of tubes. And in the recovery room, the child life specialist said, you know, Dr. Grundfest, I don't think his speech is going to develop even after you put the tubes in. I think there's something wrong with this child. I think he might have autism spectrum disorder. This is a non-MD child life specialist who made the diagnosis. That child absolutely had autism spectrum disorder, or true autism. So the diagnosis was made not by me, but by a child life specialist. So, Julie, we have all these issues. What's the role of the otolaryngologist?
Thank you. I put on this cartoon here. Basically, it's a physician reassuring the mother. He's developing just fine. The babies in those commercials aren't really talking.
You mean like the financial company?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I put that on there because this panel is really focused on the otherwise healthy child who then turns out to have good hearing. So even when I look at them, I can't tell who's really delayed or not. So in our initial visit, I'm sure like everyone else in the audience, I try to ask questions to differentiate between is it enunciation issue versus actually a lack of development in vocabulary, and just identify did they have perceived hearing issues. In this day and age, I rarely meet someone who has not either passed a newborn hearing screen or in that first year have had multiple assessments done to us if they failed it. And then, of course, I've learned to ask them, does anyone else besides you understand your child? And then review potential risk factors, the prenatal birth history, et cetera. I have learned to ask some questions, just general questions about oral motor and oropharyngeal competency, and if they're already sitting in your office sucking on a thumb and a pacifier, that seems to be easy. I have to say, in 10 years, I have followed probably just a handful of children from birth till school age where they came to me non-syndromic, otherwise healthy, mouth is always open, tongue is hanging out, excessive drooling. Of course, I do nasopharyngoscopy to make sure it's not because of adenoid hypertrophy, and in fact, they don't have that. And even after having years of oral motor therapy, you know, it takes 5-6 years before cognitively you can tell the child to keep your tongue in. So, and I would love to ask the panelists or anyone in the audience, anecdotally, I seem to now identify a possible relationship or correlation between those with a dysphagia history and speech delay.
What? Yes, definitely. If you've got a problem with, from my perspective, if you've got a problem with feeding and swallowing, you're going to have a problem with speech because speech is a secondary system built on top of a primary system of eating.
Great. And then often I'm the first subspecialist this family is meeting, so of course I want to know, have they already had formal evaluation by speech-language pathologists, and do they carry a diagnosis, whether it's specific to speech or medically, and if they've already started any therapy. So it takes all that just to get to the ENT part, which of course I'm reviewing the middle year history, if they failed, what's going on, if they've had tubes, and then the exam I think is critical. Of course, this is where, I won't lie, as an otolaryngologist, if you see fluid, you kind of go, ooh, there's something I may be able to impact. But again, we're here to talk about mostly the times when you look and the year's great. I really can't blame it on that. Establishing a hearing level will always generally happen during the otolaryngology visit, either before I go into the room or after I get to this part of the assessment. I have to admit that over the last couple of years in my practice on the university side, a couple of our audiologists, we've really come to appreciate the value of tympanometry with otoacoustic emission because that gives you very frequency-specific information in this age group when generally cooperation or just the speech awareness threshold to me is not as informative. So we've been utilizing that with good success.
Julie, have you ever had one of the audiologists who you've worked with for a considerable time come to tell you after the testing that there's something behaviorally wrong with the child and that tips you off to autism spectrum or other? I mean, when they're sitting and trying to do play audiometry, they have a sense as to whether the child's behavior is within the range of normal, but they're pretty good about picking up. Have any of the panelists ever had that experience where an audiologist will say, Dr. Manning, have you thought about this child having autism spectrum?
Sure, but again, I think for all of us, you can often get a big clue walking in the room. I mean, we have a sink with foot pedals, and the child that's under the sink with their hands under the water, that's just in some kind of a zen situation, that child has autism. Or if they've taken all their toy dinosaurs and lined them up in a precise row of height order and they won't make eye contact. So I'm serious. I mean, you can often, and the poor parents often, you know, somewhere in the back of their mind they're suspicious, but it hasn't really.
That's indicative of ADD. Yeah, question from the audience.
Yeah. I've had experience, I'm just asking the panel what they think about it. I've had some kids where they have delayed speech, we do a hearing test, they have normal audiogram, normal OAEs, and for some reason I order a brainstem testing and that comes back as abnormal.
So Peter, can you handle that one?
Yeah, certainly you see that, and especially in the younger children who may have, you know, a neural dysfunction, a lot of that will clear over time. But I think that is, if you're really going to run things to ground, especially in a younger patient, I think that is really an important thing that you do have to do because you definitely will catch that every once in a while. Now, a lot of those, they'll sort of grow out of at some point. But it sort of brings up the better question to me, and especially as we get really subspecialized, and I'm the guiltiest of them all, and Julie was sort of referring to it a little bit. You get the kid that walks in with fluid in their ear and these issues, and we put the tubes and we go, there you go, done. You know, we've done our bit. And I think it's really important to really be able to track these things down and also for the parents to be able to say, this may or may not fix it. And the kids that, some of the kids I have a hard time with, and I'm not seeing specifically pediatrics, but with kids that come in with maybe some kind of a hearing problem, and then you look at the kid that Scott was referring to, Now you have to start to have this really very uncomfortable conversation with the parents that, no, actually, you know, your unilateral hearing loss child, their issues are much, much bigger than that. And that, I think, is a psychological conversation that can be tremendously difficult when we recognize something that, yeah, there is a physical problem here, but that's probably not really the main issue.
So here's what I have learned. I've gotten a lot smarter by working with our speech-language pathology counterparts, which I didn't know about. In the last 10 years, I've lived in Kansas City, which is in two states, Missouri and Kansas. So as Carla already explained, I have really learned over the years, how can I best counsel the families, give them some basic information about the speech evaluation process, as well as the services that are provided. So it all depends on the day. Many days I cross back and forth in two states on the same day. If I'm working at Children's Mercy in the Missouri side, the program there for children younger than age 3 is called First Steps. On the Kansas side, it's called Infant Toddler Services. So in your state, it may be called that or something else. Very important, what I've learned is that the parents are the ones who have to initiate the contact. So even though I can say hearing is great, here's a copy of your hearing test, I now tell them consistently, you have to initiate the contact. And as Carla alluded to, the qualifications for who qualifies for services are dependent by the state. On the Missouri side, for example, you have to be 50% delayed in two areas of language. You know, if you're 27 months old and you have to be at the level of a 13 months or younger to qualify for services. Now, if a child has medical condition like cleft or craniofacial anomalies, the medical diagnosis itself will qualify them, serves as another way to qualify for services. Next. Okay. So the service it then determines the eligibility and frequency for which speech therapy may be provided. I have learned that in both states, they try to do what's called in-home or natural environment. So when they actually get speech therapy in the children younger than 3, somebody comes to the house generally once a week. Children age 3 and younger, there's no charge to the parents. So our state and federal taxes cover those costs. And as mentioned before, children often receive other types of developmental therapies. Now, this is where it got complicated, and I'm glad I know a little more about this now. The children we see who are older than 3, then those previous programs do not apply. This is where the parents have to request a full assessment by physically going into their school district, and I've learned that this is key. So parents have to request it. And this is important because from the moment they physically go in, sign the paper to request, there's a 45-day period. So the clock starts where the school then is responsible and has to complete the assessment and plan in 45 days. And those who are 3 to kindergarten may qualify for early childhood special education program. If they don't, they may be referred to other programs like Head Start, Early Start, and this is where parents may have to drive their kids themselves. So each school district sets its own criteria. And then if the parents, let's say, of a 4-year-old never thought their kid was speech delayed and then they go on to go to the school, it requires then that the teacher senses there's a delay, then they'll send concerns to the SLP in the district, which then may decide this child needs screening or a full assessment. But if it's been determined that the child needs assessment, then what they do is send a request home to the parents who must sign for consent for assessment. So you can, now I can truly understand why I'm not seeing really young kids, because my gosh, the whole process could take months. And once the assessment is done, then this is where you hear about the IEP or individual education plan. And I have learned that it seems like our school districts are overloaded. The speech language therapy sessions then are done in groups, and oftentimes treatments may even be done by a speech aid because there just aren't enough SLPs to provide the services for what they're facing. But the schools determine eligibility and intervention. And finally, the factors that I consider as a pediatric otolaryngologist, of course, the medical comorbidities, which you'll hear about from the other panelists. Our SLPs, both on both sides, whether I'm working at the university or children's, both systems have a satellite services in the suburban area versus the main medical center in the urban area. So the perception is that we have a higher no-show rate for the assessment, for the follow-ups, when patients are scheduled at the urban centers. And then if you have managed care programs, as similar to qualifications for ear tubes, sometimes your families are required simply to wait longer before they're approved to get an assessment. And then by the time you meet the family, they will share with you how long it took to get into CU. And by the way, for example, at Children's Mercy, the parents have to initiate a questionnaire, send it to the hearing and speech department. And I have to admit, oftentimes they'll say, well, they said they would call us and we never heard. And so we have some access issues as well.
So it sounds like the easiest route was the early intervention route when they're toddlers or infants. Yeah. So case number four, Kevin is 22 months of age and he's not speaking. When he was born, he had newborn hearing screening tests that showed normal hearing in the left ear, but severe hearing impairment in the right ear. Is he not speaking because he's not hearing in the right ear? Does this make sense? Does he need to have a hearing aid, Peter?
Well, and this is a big one in my practice as an otologist, where people will show up, and it's not necessarily even that young. It's older kids that have other issues. And I think there's data that sort of supports the idea that a unilateral hearing loss can have effects on people's education. We would assume that a single hearing ear is enough to have speech and language come along. Now, that's the caveat to that would be that everybody knows that child doesn't hear out of one ear. And literally having a parent doing story time with the kid's good ear facing away really could have significant effects on their speech and language abilities. But most of the time, once they know that it's there, that's probably all they need. Now, if they have a usable ear, putting a hearing aid on it is certainly a reasonable thing to do. And there are other social issues that come along with it. As you know, parents trying to keep hearing aids on kids and then coming in frantic because I can't keep this hearing aid on my child and I'm really afraid that's going to cause a big trouble. So there are multiple studies that support the idea that there are educational issues that come along with unilateral hearing loss. And there's some nice papers out there that sort of look at a bunch of different studies that suggested that there were problems with failing grades and some sort of more vague things like, you know, the parents noted difficulties with the child's education. And these studies are quoted a lot, and one of the things that I have to talk to parents about is all these various things we have for unilateral hearing loss. And we've got sort of a lot of tools nowadays. And these studies will get pulled up, and sometimes it's almost a little bit self-serving that you kind of look at a parent that says, gee, I'm afraid my child's going to be held back. Can't I get the fill-in-the-blank surgical procedure to help with unilateral hearing loss? But there are other studies that suggest that really there's not much to it, that some large studies that have shown that there really doesn't seem to be a big difference if you only have a unilateral loss. And I think Scott may touch on this a little bit later on, but there may be differences in which ear you don't hear out of. And there's clearly differences in, next please, there's clearly differences in kids that have zero intervention that nobody even knew had that problem. So I think once you find that child, you know, making it clear that some of these studies about kids getting staying behind a year and things like that are kids that haven't, there's been no intervention at all on, even so much as putting them up in the front of the class and making sure the teacher's talking into the correct ear. So that sometimes helps the parents who have seen some of this data and are very concerned. Next, please. And so I do think there are some common sense approaches to be brought into play just from a straight hearing standpoint, not necessarily changing their language, for instance, for a unilateral hearing loss. I, for one, always talk about enlarged vestibular aqueduct in these children. It's one of the few things that we can actually look at and say going forward, here's some things you should not do if you have this. Now, I'm a little bit of a minimalist when it comes to this in that I don't think it's realistic as a parent as well to tell someone with a 2-year-old little boy who's otherwise normal, make sure he doesn't fall down and hit his head. I mean, you want to talk about the need for psychiatric treatment for the poor parent afterwards if you tell them that. So I look for those things a little bit later on when we really truly can make some kind of an intervention. I think that these are, again, important questions to be able to take to those parents and then to go to a professional as far as someone to evaluate what really is their speech like. I mean, most of the time when you have a child like this, I find the hearing loss really has nothing to do with it, and it's some of the other things that we have seen.
The unilateral hearing loss.
Yeah, unilateral, I'm sorry.
Other panel, raise your hand if you agree with Peter. The unilateral Audience, what do you think? Unilateral hearing loss, is that a common cause for speech delay? If so, raise your hand if you believe it is. I don't think it is. So there's general consensus there. Peter, go ahead. Oh, please.
Let me just make a comment. Dr. Stevens from Salt Lake. I have a brother who was born without any hearing in one ear. We didn't know it until he was 8 years of age when he got on the telephone and realized he couldn't hear in one ear. We got a scan and realized that there was no development of his ear. And he has done perfectly well. And the fact that we were not even aware of it until he was that age makes me sort of feel like this is less of a problem in an otherwise normal family situation.
Thank you for your comment. I think that was the consensus of the panel. And in my experience, before we had universal newborn hearing screening, which we've had for many decades now, prior to that, in my experience, the unilateral severe hearing loss was detected at what they used to call kindergarten roundup at age 5, so many families never knew that their child had a severe loss of hearing in one ear until they, we'll take a quick comment and then we're going
to
go ahead, Alan.
I want to get back to the comment about the large aqueduct. If we're thinking something like a Mondini, doesn't that put us into a bit of a legal liability if we don't tell the parents he's got to wear a helmet, et cetera? I mean, that's a real tough one. I don't know how to handle that one.
Well, I think you do. I think you tell them all those things. Helmets don't help necessarily for a variety of reasons. But yeah, I do tell them that. I say, you know, there is a possibility of this. But I also tell them, you know, you have a child who needs to develop motor skills and do other things, and there's sort of a limited ability for you to kind of protect that kid against literally all the bumps and bruises in life. So I mention it, but I think that's it.
So let's go through your last few,
sure.
Peter, just relatively briefly. Interventions?
So I think interventionally, the first thing that we did that's maybe the biggest thing is telling them it's there. So sort of to the point that was made that, and I tell parents, story time should be on the good ear. I mean, simple things that really people figure out very quickly. That's probably all you need for most patients. I mean, how many of us have kids with unilateral hearing loss that are, you know, straight-A students going to Harvard, and I got a bunch of them. For those kids where there's still questions as to whether there's issues, I think the next reasonable step are things like FM systems. We know the teacher sound is now getting to their ear. Theoretically, one ear being gone shouldn't change it. And I think the last things are the hearing aids, the cross systems, the bone conduction systems. Again, I think it's a little self-serving for us, for me, or otologists as surgeons, to walk in somebody under 5 and maybe outside of FDA criteria for things and say, oh, that kid needs a Baha or they're going to stay behind a year. And sometimes you see that kind of a mindset. And so I think it's very important to think a little bit about the social consequences going on of those children versus what we already know, which is a lot of these kids do really, really well.
And finally, more aggressive treatment for otitis
right.
media.
And I think, again,
that's a given.
Common sense.
Okay. Scott, does heredity affect timing of speech development?
Okay. So I will, regarding this slide, last week at Seattle Children's, in between cases, I had a medical student helping me with Google Images. And the first 30 or so ones that I picked, she deemed as inappropriate. So we found this plus size with no person in it. But yes, so moving on, if you're going to look for a genotype, you have to understand the phenotype. That's part of the problem when you get to complex things that are hard to define, as we've mentioned, and that are, I'm sure, polygenetic. So I'm not the speech pathologist, but they are, as we sort of alluded to, we're getting a little bit more specific on how to focus in. This is a term that crops up whenever you get into the gene literature now, the specific language impairment that has, you know, as we've mentioned before, these components that can be a part of it, and it can be all mixed together. And it is a diagnosis of exclusion, as we've heard. And as we've also heard, these patients do have increased risk of other developmental delays and so forth. Ken's going faster than I can go. I'm moving really quick. But it's, and as we've also heard, it is about 5 to 8% of non-syndromic preschool kids, highly heritable, as we've alluded to. And I'm not a geneticist, and I'm not going to get into this too much, other than to say, as with everything, there's an explosion in new knowledge due to new techniques. And it started off in language with some clusters of families with severe dyslexia that crossed generations, where they were able to do linkage studies. Now, here are some areas like the FOXP2, et cetera. Next. I got that in. And so if you look through, for those of you that understand genetics much better than I, like Farrell, for example, The bottom line is we've gone from linkage studies that could identify single genes, you know, usually more dominant associations, to the SNP studies from our library. Unfortunately, if our library doesn't have it in it, then we can't find it. But now, what's really fascinating, because, and I do know something about this because we're using it for our vascular anomaly studies of our tissue bank, with exome sequencing, the exomes are a library of about 1% of human genome that codes most of the proteins. And then the microRNA are another even smaller library of things that mostly derive from introns that regulate usually non-expression of genes. But using these much more focused things, we can much more cost-effectively analyze things. So you're about to see a massive explosion in new knowledge. Next. So there's the main messages. Next, we'll skip that. A lot of association between those genes and autism type things that we mentioned. But here's what we should not miss, and this is the main point of my lecture. So this is what I try to emphasize. Chromosome 22q11 is the most common single gene deletion in people, 1 in 4,000. We're all aware of DeGeorge syndrome, but there's this whole spectrum of people who don't have the cardiac disease, and they don't all have this phenotypic facial expression either, as in this patient with the flat malar eminence and the tubular nose and the low-set ears and otitis media, et cetera. But expressive speech delay is the most common thing. Next.
So just Scott, when should we be suspicious? When?
Okay, so when
is it this facies? When should we be suspicious?
We should be suspicious in any kid that looks like that, which also to me looks a lot like fetal alcohol, by the way, which is usually diagnosed.
I agree.
But we should also be suspicious in anyone that has extraordinary expressive speech delay, as you've learned today, that doesn't fit the expected norm for other reasons, diagnosis of exclusion.
Thanks.
Next. And again, these kids really lag their peers in expressive speech delay by age 1, and there's this big overlap with autism, chronic middle ear fluid, and they don't, and only a relatively small percent are going to have an abnormal palate. You can do a simple FISH test, which does not require insurance pre-authorization, unlike every other genetic test in our state, and we need to have a low threshold for doing that test for chromosome 22q11 deletion. Next.
That's easily available, commercially
available. Okay. No insurance approval, not in our state.
Okay.
And this, I'll throw one more, this mosaic trisomy 21, and that's very tricky because they can look pretty normal. Here in this particular patient, they have some epicanthal folds and so forth, but you know, they can look pretty darn normal and be pretty darn normal, except for, you know, as they get a little older, more and more deviation from the norm of the family history and everything else of expressive speech delay. And they're a little tricky too. You got to do a buccal swab or lymphocytic testing specifically for mosaic trisomy 21, because it may be as low as 4 to 12% of their cells are mosaic trisomy 21. So it's our job, again, to make these diagnoses early when developmentally we can benefit better from speech therapy. Next.
Is there a difference in the cognitive potential of mosaic trisomy 21 versus
It's something like average trisomy 21, average IQ is maybe 50, and mosaic trisomy 21 is about 78, which is also similar on average to chromosome 22q11. But there's a wide range there. Next. And so just I want to throw this out in my buddy Dr. Rubin. Just remember that communication is the currency of success in the modern world. It's right in our wheelhouse to kind of figure out and help. And also, when you're talking about practice management guidelines, evidence-based medicine, a lot of them come from the lucky, the people that had the good genes, so they had the good job, so they had money, so they had a car, they had a telephone, and they could participate in Jack Paradise's studies. Well, you know, in my clinic, I got the opposite. The bad genes, the low socioeconomic status, the underemployed, the teenage mother, back to work at Starbucks, can't breastfeed, cigarette smoking, and on and on. And in those kids, if they have fluid, we can help them a lot more than Dr. Paradise might say. And that's all I want to say about that.
So just for the audience, and so just to get comments of everybody on the panel, just give a brief summary of the landmark study that Paradise did on insertion of tubes early after diagnosis or later after diagnosis, and
and he and I actually work with Dr. Paradise actually doing it, and talking about it in brief is really hard. But in brief, in the select in his patient population of the lucky, wealthy people with good language genes, early tubing did not select their language learning, which was good across the board. But again, my point is, not everybody is genetically lucky in that way. We have to remember that. But a lot of the studies come from the genetically lucky.
And so the conclusion that many primary care physicians and pediatricians drew from that study was that you don't have to be overly aggressive about inserting tubes in the ears of children who are hearing impaired. And for just a moment, I would like to have the opinion of the panelists in regard to exactly what Dr. Manning just brought up. That is, do we, when we confront a disadvantaged child from the inner city with one parent who has fluid in both ears and is kind of struggling to keep up with peers, do we have a different indication for insertion of tubes in that child versus the child described by Scott as coming from a more advantaged family with two parents who are very articulate and have college degrees or postgraduate degrees? What's the sense of the panelists? We haven't heard from you, Ron. And actually, you bring, I'm glad to ask you because you bring the perspective of the Bill Wilkerson Center at Nashville, and you know, they've been studying these kind of things for years. So what's your approach?
Well, to get to the exact patient, you mentioned the disadvantaged patient. We all face right now the philosophical conflict of, do we use evidence-based medicine, which means Jack's study, versus personalized medicine, which is up and coming. And we're personalizing medicine with genetics. We now know we can treat melanoma and lung cancer with targeted therapy. Do we treat the patients as individuals? So I'd agree with you, that particular patient that's in your office, it's time to do something for that patient and give them every advantage you can.
Other panelists want to comment?
I think you do. I think you have to look at them individually, and I think that is one of the problems, is we get these studies and we just assume that that's actually the truth, like a universal truth that we figured it out. But most of the time, it's garbage in and garbage out, and I don't mean garbage in a bad way. I just mean that group that you studied, yes, absolutely, that's the result. But to your point, that's not necessarily who we're treating. And it sort of goes back to what you were saying earlier, even about the ankyloglossia, right? If the parent who just, you can never explain to them that maybe this isn't it, your risk-benefit ratio for snipping that piece of skin is different. And so I think that is actually a good argument for us as physicians to the idea that we're not in the near future going to become the technicians that just picks up the thing and goes, well, here's the guidelines, which is sort of, you know, as many people want us to go that direction. There's too much individual stuff there, and too much of this stuff that we sort of stand up and joke about. Well, it's an N of one. Yeah, but an N of one done over 20 years, there's data there, and maybe we're not teasing out what we need, but I think we have to treat the individual.
So, Scott, I think we know your opinion, but Julie, do we know your opinion? We heard. Okay, Julie, go ahead.
I just couldn't agree with Scott more. The families that the population you're seeing that I'm seeing, they oftentimes don't even have an identified primary care provider. They say, I go to this clinic. They're seeing a different provider. Many of them are trainees. Nothing against trainees. But the point is, I know they're having a harder time accessing good information, healthcare, et cetera. And I just want to clarify that earlier when I talked as a mother and the indication of ankyloglossia, I did say if anatomically indicated. So in no way did I say that you do a sham procedure and clip if it's not anatomically relevant. And I want to make one more comment about unilateral hearing loss. You know, I walked away from my training early on in my career, reassuring myself and the families that, oh, the other side is normal, and human beings can acquire speech and develop fine, even if you are deaf in 1 year. But I have learned since then, Judy Liu just from WashU and her group presented, for example, that it does impact school performance in school-age children. I go to enough meetings, even though I'm not the neurologist, we're now having all this data that children who are implanted on both sides do remarkably better. So there has to be a difference. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't be hearing that.
Yeah, and I think there's no question there's differences. The question is the only way to fix that difference by putting in an implant or doing something else? I think it really has to do with the individual child and saying, you get the straight-A student with unilateral hearing loss, do they have to have a Baha or a, you know, a FM system or something else? Again, going back to sort of what you're talking about, versus perhaps another child who isn't getting good stuff, good education, help at home, and is missing out on things. So again, that goes back to the whole idea this has to be individualized, but we also can't use it as a cudgel and say,
every, you know, oh my God, you didn't do something for your poor child with unilateral hearing loss, and now they're not going to Harvard. I mean, that clearly is not true either. So I think we just have to be careful not to, again, not to hit, go after everything with a blunt instrument, I guess.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and Ron Evie is going to tie some things together for us, but I want to make sure if anybody has a question, please go ahead. You look like you were almost having a question. Please, we'll take, is that okay with you, Ron, if we take the questions and then let's, I want to make
just,
sure you
I just have one comment, and yes. That was, Julie had some great comments about the access for early care. And Congress and the IDEA of 2004, what they call the regional centers. So if you're looking, every state, every county has a regional center, and that is for providing services. And there's a break off at age three. Before age three, the primary responsibility is the regional centers in the county. After age three, it's the school district. And then after age three, the school district is primarily responsible, but services not provided by the school district, the regional center will then serve as a backup. And unfortunately, the access is very, very different across states. And you know, California, where I live, it's pretty well funded. Other states, it's pretty bad. But that's, if you look and you got a kid, you need to get access to services, look at regional centers.
That makes a lot of sense. Like for the younger children, before they're linked to a school district, it goes by the region. But once they're closer to school age, the school system takes over.
Yeah, Congress is very, very
thank you. Thank you for the clarification, yes.
I have a question. When you do the genetic testing, chromosome 22, Q11, and others, are you looking for any associated problem also besides speech delay? Is those gene also cause other problems that we have to look for the kids?
Scott, do you want to
I couldn't hear. Can you tell me what it was?
You know, I think the question was genetic other, testing. Once you, if it's a 22, Q11, or...
Oh, if that's normal?
What is so, you're asking if there are associated things we should be looking for,
cardiac,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Right. You go through the whole history. My point, though, is that those are usually identified. It's the kids that don't have the other phenotype that we identify, and the trigger is expressive speech delay to start thinking about it.
But once you find that, should you refer them to any other physician specifically, or there is no association
yet?
Oh,
if we find
geneticist
it, we refer to genetics clinic, and speech therapy is the main point of this, yeah.
Not necessarily cardiac, but, you know.
There's no other disease associated already.
Renal, cardiac?
Not. Oh, yeah.
The clinical geneticist will usually work through that.
We make sure they're worked up, but usually that part has already happened before they get to us at speech delay.
So, Ron, I think we just have a couple of minutes. Do you want to pull everything together?
Sure, that'll be really simple. I got some ideas from, we have about 80 speech pathologists and about 30 audiologists, so I was able to pull together some ideas. But one I want to pick up on is Scott's, when he talked about Bob Rubin, and we're in the communication era. Our specialty of otolaryngology, speech and hearing and ophthalmology are now the gateway to all disease if it's not genetic. Disease is genetic or it's environmental, and the environment isn't a saber-toothed tiger anymore. It's, I couldn't stop eating, doctor. I put that food in my mouth. I couldn't stop drinking, doctor. So we actually, we choose to go to war because of things we hear. So we actually are the specialties for everything that's non-genetic health, and we have to reframe how we think about ourselves. We're the gateway. We make sure that people can hear. We can make sure that we can speak things clearly. You can have a laryngectomy, and you can be deaf, and you're still alive. But you're really not the same person. So the railroad industry was in trouble because it thought it was in the railroad industry and it was in transportation industry. So what industry are we in? We're in communication and we're into behavior and health. So the earlier we get involved with these kids to make sure their communication works, the better off they are. The categories Carla went over, this is the buckets of what you can think about. Next slide, please, Ken. I asked Steve Camerota, what do you do quickly in the office as a screen? And like Carla said, you ask, can the kid understand? If you say, where's the ball? And he looks at the ball, can you go in the next room and bring your toy back to me? And if they do that, Steve says the odds are this kid's going to be great. Kid make an eye contact, is he playing? And there's a difference between, is somebody grunting? Or babbling. Babbling will precede speech. Grunting is not the sound that you want to hear. He also said, think about your parents. You have the laissez-faire parents that aren't really concerned. They may not help at home. And you also have the perfectionistas. that this child is now 11 months old and I'm not hearing mommy yet. What's wrong with my child? Next. He suggests following the child's lead, and he gave me a cookie story. If you have a child that's not speaking, you say, "Here, Joey, say cookie, and I'll give you a cookie." Joey can't say cookie, so you don't give Joey the cookie. So Joey learns you're the person who teases him and doesn't give him anything, and they withdraw from you. He says, follow the child's lead, and if Joey looks at the cookie, you say, "Joey, this is a cookie," and then you give the cookie. He also talks about in Down syndrome, how important we are in communication, that the fact that we have, once the kid's heart disease is taken care of, what are the parents concerned about? How's my kid going to do in society? How's my kid going to hear and speak? He also pointed out that for autism, the group, the most famous group is Autism Speaks. It's not Autism Sleeps, because autism kids don't sleep. It's not Autism Make Eye Contact or Autism Stop Flapping. It's Autism Speaks. So again, reinforcing the fact that what we do in communication with hearing and language is so important.
So I might have to...
We'll cut it off there.
Yeah, because I don't want to delay the next group coming in. But I want to really sincerely thank my panelists who put a lot of work and effort into pulling this information together. I hope you gained a little something from it. But thank you very, very much to all of you for putting in the work. Thank you.